The following message is from Sierra Community Church. To find out more about our church, visit us on the web at sierra.church.
Hey, church family. Thanks for joining us today. I am Nick, if you don't know me, and I'm on staff here at the church. But this is not something that I do very often out of all my job responsibilities. But I'm excited, nonetheless, to share with you today what God has been teaching me this week in our study. But before I get to the message, I have a few announcements for you guys. And so this time of year, typically we have so much going on here at the church. Lori and her team have not ceased work. Now, they are not meeting, but they are meeting. Well, what do I mean? So Lori has been doing Kids Quest. Oh, that went way too fast. Lori has been doing Kids Quest and Breakout over the past, 10 weeks. Wow. And they celebrated this week with kind of their year-end wrap-up. And what a cool way to do that, because her and her team got supplies together, took it to the families so that the kids could decorate behind them in their Zoom little boxes, windows. And as you can tell, they had a blast. And so some of the kids here, just it looks like they had a great time with the balloons and the noisemakers. So just a huge thank you to the leaders and the teachers that help her with this throughout the year. And so we have Allie, Deborah, Tammy, and Camille. Thank you so much for your faithfulness in teaching these kids and showing up and studying every week for this. And Lori, thank you for the hard work that you do to serve our community and our church families. Now, they also, Breakout did their celebrations, and they had a great time as well. You know, the Breakout kids are a little bit older, a little bit more creative. So I love what Caden has here. Caden had like a disco ball in his background, so he was really partying. And a couple other people had some really fun decorations too. So I'm glad they really got to enjoy that time. Now, again, the leaders here, Dan and Alicia, Joe Garcia, and Hillary and Marlene, plus Jason Cox, thank you so much as well for your guys' hard work and investment in the church families here. So, you know what? Seeing Joe's face there, that smiling face, I miss you, Joe. And looking forward to when we all get to be back together. So, Lori, thank you again for your hard work. Now, we do have one congratulations here for Kyle Nunez. This time of year, we celebrate the kids that have gone through Kids Quest and Breakout all the way. They finish it, and then they get to join Corbett and myself in junior high. And so, Kyle, we welcome you to that, but congratulations on finishing. And I guarantee you won't be the only junior hire, but we're stoked to have you. So now, one other announcement that I wanted to bring up to you guys. If you haven't been paying attention, we have these videos getting posted once a week called 15 Minutes With, where we take someone from our church congregation or a missionary and try and interview them the best we can. Now, disclaimer here, Noah and I don't normally stick to 15 minutes, all right? Yeah, we can talk a little bit as well as the people that we interview. So we've tried to make it enjoyable for you, an opportunity to get to know some other church family. And so this week you get a interview with Tom Barnes. Now, personally, Tom Barnes is pretty intimidating if you haven't ever talked to him before, which most of you probably have. In the interview, I want to encourage you to watch it, because Tom shares some insights and some stories that I don't think you've ever heard, and really fun to get to know a little bit more about Tom. So I encourage you to watch that, hopefully even after the message, if you have time. So, real quick here, we are getting into the message today, and we are in the book of John, and looking at who the real Jesus is. Now, in my study this week, I know that we are familiar with this story. It's the story of Jesus walking on water. And in reading this week and preparing for the message, I know this story is sometimes actually even hard for some people to believe. Many of you probably already actually even have your mind made up as to what the lesson is in this story. But I want to invite you today to take a fresh look at what is going on here. Especially with what God has been teaching me, I hope he has something new to teach you as well. In the story of walking on water, you know what? I thought it'd be fun to Just think about Jesus. If he was an adult and he did these miracles, what would it have been like for Jesus as a baby? Would he still do those miracles? And we all know parents. When parents are trying to get their kids ready for bath time, that actually seems like a miracle when you get them in. And so, of course, it would be just as challenging with Jesus trying to get him to take a bath. Now, I was also thinking, Jesus, sometimes you wonder if he just shows off. Does he just do these miracles to just show how big and, you know, extravagant he can be? And if he does, at the least, Jesus, you need to behave yourself, okay? Don't run on the water, all right? Walking is good enough, okay? You don't need to put us all to shame by running on it too. So, now, did you know that you can actually walk on water yourself? Yeah, last fall, Air Jordans released a shoe called, I think they called it the Walk on Water, but they actually filled the soles of the shoe, where you see that little bit of blue there, with water from Israel, from the Jordan River. So you literally could walk on the water every day of your life. It only costs you $3,000, but you can do it. So anyways, walk on water, it's a very common image that we use in our culture today. Politically, we use it with sports analogies, and it's a fun passage for us to look at as well. Now, last week, Noah got us into chapter 6, looking at the feeding of the 5,000 and talking about why hunger matters. And so in verse 14, the end of it, it says, after the people saw the sign Jesus performed, they began to say, surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world. Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself. I'd encourage you to go back and listen to Noah's message, because he does a great job of pulling out some insights that I had never considered before in that miracle. Now, we pick it up in verse 16 here. When evening came, his disciples went down to the lake, where they got into a boat and set off across the lake for Capernaum. Now, a little context here. We're looking at the Sea of Galilee. That's where they were at. And this red pin on the right side is the east side of the lake. And the feeding of the 5,000, or more like 15,000 to 20,000 people, was on the east side of the lake here in the hills. And the disciples now are on the shore on the east side of the lake, heading back to Capernaum, which is where they spent a lot of their time at in this region. Now, a boat at that time is a little different than our boats today. As you can see here, their boats were made of wood, and they had sails on them to get them across the sea, but they also had the option to row it, and then so they had oars. Now, the sides of the boat, they were a little bit lower, so when they pulled the fish into the boat, they didn't have to heave it over. And so that will come in handy as we think about later on what happens here in the story. We pick it back up in verse 17, by now it was dark and Jesus had not yet joined them. And so I want to just stop here and think, why was Jesus not here? Typically, Jesus is with his disciples when they are doing life together. This time, he's not. Thankfully, Mark and Matthew, who also include this story and this account, give us some extra details to show us what's going on. So after the feeding of the 5,000, Matthew records, immediately Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side, while he dismissed the crowd. So Jesus actually sends the disciples away from him so he can get a little peace and quiet. Kind of makes sense when they're trying to take you by king by force. We pick it back up here in verse 18. A strong wind was blowing and the waters grew rough. Now, this is actually really common here on the Sea of Galilee. So the Mediterranean Sea is on the left side here, far over. And what would happen is the winds would come across the land and then hit the Sea of Galilee. And what would happen is you'd have this westerly wind that would come up and hit the Golan Heights, which is on the east side. Typically, these can go up to about 1,500 feet in elevation. And so these wind storms can become pretty fierce, pretty dangerous. The Jewish people were not very fond of the water. And so even today, a storm like that is pretty dangerous to be in. Modern boats won't even go out on the Sea of Galilee in a storm like that. And so, let alone now these disciples are in a little wooden boat. They're not in some nice modern boat. And they are in the middle of the dark, middle of the night, rowing across the sea. We come back here in verse 19. When they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus approaching the boat, walking on the water. And they were frightened. So I want to stop and just think about what would the disciples have felt in this moment. Lake wind advisory is in effect. They can't go on their smartphone, pull up Weather Channel, see when the wind is going to start, and say, you know what, maybe tonight's not a good night to row. Nope. They're caught in the middle of the lake, 3 to 4 miles in. The lake is about 7 miles wide, so it's good little evidence for us that they are in the middle. And they are tired. One of the other things that's interesting here is that I think after the feeding of the 5,000, I think the disciples were confused, maybe disappointed. The expectation that they had when Jesus invites them into the feeding of the 5,000 is, hey, how are you guys going to feed these people? And Andrew replies, well, we can't. That's impossible. That's so expensive. We don't have the money to feed 15 to 20,000 people. And then Jesus does the impossible. I think as they're heading to shore and Jesus is not with them, sending them away, there's got to be a little confusion here as to, we just saw something that is crazy. And Jesus is telling us to leave. It's dark. They're in the middle of a windstorm. They're rowing. And so you got to imagine them just being exhausted physically and even emotionally. And because of the danger of the windstorm, they're probably fearful for their life. I don't think they looked at water the same way we do that. Oh, let's just go for a swim. I think they were very much afraid. And so all of a sudden, Jesus appears walking on the water and they're frightened. Well, were they frightened because of Jesus or were they frightened because of the storm? That is a good question. Again, thankfully, Mark and Matthew help us because as Matthew says here, when the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. It's a ghost, they said, and cried out in fear. I think regardless, there's a figure appearing to them, and in their exhaustion, there is a sense of, we do not know what's going on right now. Again, Mark here records a story where similar, the disciples were with Jesus in another storm. And in that storm, Jesus was actually with them in the boat. And they cry out to Jesus asking for help, and he saves them at this time. Now they're in the middle of a storm without Jesus, and I don't think they know what to do. And so we pick it back up here in verse 20, where Jesus says to them, "It is I, don't be afraid." This is a pivotal moment for this story. And there's two things I want us to focus on. First of all, it is I. The phrase that Jesus is saying there, "it is I," in Greek is "I am." Now, to us, that doesn't make any sense at all. I am, don't be afraid. Huh? So I am is connected to the Old Testament. It's connected to this picture, to this name of who God is. And where we first really see it come into play is where God reveals himself to Moses in a burning bush in the book of Exodus, chapter 3. And in this story, Moses asks God, "So who should I tell the people that sent me? Who should I say that you are?" And God responds to Moses saying, "Tell them I am. I am sent you." I am refers to the name Yahweh. It's a name we see throughout the Old Testament. And so this week I found a verse in Isaiah that actually I think captures this really well. It says, "O Israel, the one who formed you says, do not be afraid, for I have ransomed you. I have called you by name. You are mine. When you go through deep waters, I will be with you. When you go through rivers of difficulty, you will not drown. When you walk through the fire of oppression, you will not be burned up. The flames will not consume you. For I am the Lord, your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior. The picture here of the name of Yahweh is that he will deliver his people. It connects to this name that for the Jewish people was a powerful and important and holy name. David Mark Ball, in a commentary this week, captures this, saying, most striking of all is the fact that Jesus here, in the walking on water where he says, it is I, takes on himself a phrase that in Isaiah, like I just read, is reserved for Yahweh alone, and thus intimately identifies himself with God's acts of creation and salvation, which suggests that John, who's writing this story, saw the events and words of Jesus' life as a fulfillment of that day when Israel would see the salvation of Yahweh. Again, this is a pivotal moment because Jesus is revealing himself to the disciples, and not anymore as their rabbi, and also not just as a king who cares for the hungry, but he's revealing himself as the Son of God. He's connecting himself to the Messiah, to the one who will deliver Israel, the Jewish people. That's a big claim. John is constantly trying to bring us back to this picture of who Jesus is. It's the purpose of his entire book. And he says that in John 20, like we've been coming back to every week. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. That word Messiah is Christ, Christos, that Jesus is the Christos and the Son of God. That is John's intent. Now, the other part that I want to focus on in here is the second half of what Jesus says. Do not be afraid. Don't be afraid. Don't be terrified. At this moment, I think there's a very tender connection that Jesus is making with his disciples, where in the midst of this emotional turmoil and journey that they are on, Jesus is connecting with them saying, here I am. Yahweh is here to comfort you. In the midst of the storm, I am present. And I think that's a powerful picture because personally, I easily fall back into my insecurities. Even this week in getting ready to put this message together, I recognize that I lack a confidence in who God has made me to be. I think the disciples struggle with this throughout their time with Jesus. They lack a confidence of who God is to them, wrestling with what does that mean in this insecurity. And I think the picture of them on the boat in the middle of the storm, in the middle of the night, completely exhausted, reveals this deep insecurity. And thankfully, Jesus shows up and meets them in that insecurity. Verse 21, we pick it up here where it says, they were willing to take him into the boat. So at this point, the disciples embrace Jesus. They want him with them. They are glad that he is there. And immediately the boat reached the shore where they were heading. Okay, hold on a minute. Immediately? Like instantaneously? Like miraculously? Because this is just one line, and it sure seems like it's a pretty big deal. I think John is not just putting this in here as a transition. I don't think it was haphazardly. John is writing very intentionally, and I think he includes this to make a point. And not just of the miracle, but I think he's making a point connecting to the name, connecting to who the real Jesus is. That the only one who has the power, who made the sea, who can create everything, he's the only one that also has the power to master it. And that is an important fact for us to really consider, because when we read the text, when we come to the Bible, it's so easy to read what we may think into it, especially after the Enlightenment, we are a very science-oriented people. We like to rationalize and explain and reason away things. And so it's easy to come to a text like this and say, well, maybe John is using the word immediately to, it's a time word. And so he's just really capturing that. It took some time, but they did get to shore. Even with the walking on water story, we rationalize, well, maybe it wasn't fully in deep water. Maybe they were closer to shore than we realized, or maybe. But N.T. Wright says something that I think is important for us to know here. You either come to the text, to the Bible, with a view of what is and isn't possible in the world, which won't allow any fresh evidence, or you come with at least an open mind to new possibilities. For me, this is challenging because I like to think I know what's going on, and I'm thankful that Jesus constantly is teaching us new things if we are willing to listen. Now, the last part of this story this week, I had a challenge in reading because it just seems like a natural transition. Here in 22, we pick it up, going back to the crowds on the other side of the lake. The next day, the crowd that had stayed on the opposite shore of the lake realized that only one boat had been there and that Jesus had not entered it with his disciples, but that they had gone away alone. Then some boats from Tiberias landed near the place where the people had eaten the bread after the Lord had given thanks. Once the crowd realized that neither Jesus nor his disciples were there, they got into the boats and went to Capernaum in search of Jesus. So what do we have here? Well, the crowds are observant. They've recognized that there was one boat. The disciples got in it at night and they left. Jesus was not in the boat with them. Jesus was still with the crowds, dismissing them, going away by himself. But Jesus now this next day is not there. And so they're curious, where did Jesus go? Did he walk? Did he leave? Did he get in another boat that we didn't see? Did someone else come back at night and get him? Well, again, the Tiberias people come over here, another fishing village, and they recognize that Jesus wasn't in Tiberias either. And so they're resolute. Let's go to Capernaum. Let's go find Jesus because he fed us. Maybe he'll feed us again. Is this just a transition story or is something else happening here? I think John is doing this contrast of how the crowds responded to Jesus and how the disciples responded to Jesus. And so that is, I think, important because in the realization of his absence, they missed the very real presence of God. They didn't slow down to think of what had just happened. And so that gets me to the two lessons for this week. First of all, God is always alive and at work around you. Do you take time to notice what he's trying to teach you? Or your family? Or your friends? This is the opportunity that you and I have, is God is always at work. But we are so quick to distract ourselves. We are so easily focused on just being productive. We value that in American culture. Productivity, efficiency, progression. And Jesus, I think, in his upside-down kingdom, values something a little different. I know I am the worst at being distracted. I constantly want to move on to the next thing. Stay busy. The staff here chides me for saying yes to so many things and not saying no often enough because I want to feel like I'm doing something. But more than that is, I think it's easy to be more concerned with what I can do for God or what God can give me than learning what he has to teach me. In the midst of this coronavirus, I thought from the very beginning, this is a great time that I'm going to have to spend some time reading. I like to write, and so it'd be a great time to write, journal, spend some time reflecting. And I have not done that nearly to what I thought I would. It's been 10 weeks, and I think what it's revealed is just how easily distracted I am. how difficult it is for me to really slow down. I think it's a picture that I'm a lot more like a crowd here, just like the crowd in the walking of water story, where they're more concerned about just finding Jesus and what he can bring them, another meal, as opposed to stopping and reflecting on who he really is. The opportunity we have is to be someone who learns from Jesus. A learner is someone who is an apprentice, someone who sits under a master to learn a trade, or a student who sits under a teacher to learn a skill. Another word for that is actually disciple. Disciples are learners because they sit under the authority of a rabbi. The rabbi is the one who teaches them, who walks with them. And the picture of a disciple following a rabbi is that they would do what the rabbi says and what the rabbi does. And that is the opportunity, the invitation that you and I have. We have the opportunity to sit under Jesus' authority, to participate with him in his kingdom. You can have direct access to him. You can have his presence with you if you're willing to listen, if you're willing to see what he's trying to teach you. The second lesson I think we can pull from this text is God not only cares for your hunger, but he cares for your soul. The story of Jesus walking on water after the feeding of the 5,000 connects these two pictures together, that Jesus does care for the hunger. He is a king that cares for his people. He wants them to be nourished. But he doesn't just care for that. He cares for your soul. And we have such a good picture of that when Jesus interacts with his disciples on the boat there. That connection to their fear and insecurity, to his comfort, his presence, his power. That's a very real thing. And it is just as real for us today. Jesus willingly goes through the storm. Remember, he was by himself getting a break from the crowds, spending time in prayer with his Father like he commonly did. And yet he leaves that to meet the disciples in the midst of their emotion, in the midst of that challenging situation. That's what we see in the New Testament, that Jesus humbles himself by becoming obedient, even to death on a cross. And that is the picture that we have of God, who's willing to sacrifice to save his people, that he is Yahweh, ready to deliver his people, and yet in the same time revealing the people's very real dependence on him. I think when troubles arise in our lives, we typically like to just get past it. You know, I've heard a lot of people in the midst of this coronavirus say, I just want it to go back to normal. I would love for everything to just return to the way it was. And I don't think that's what God is focused on. I think God is more concerned with our character than the conditions that we are in. It's very possible that the storms are going to continue, that the darkness is going to go a little bit longer, that you may have to row and get across the lake in the midst of the wind. It may not let up. But what great comfort in knowing that God is with you in the storm. For the disciples, that was real. The crowds, on the other hand, they missed it. Who do you think you are? In my reading this week, I found a hymn that Tim Keller read, and I think it captures this whole story really well. It was written by a man named William Cowper in 1773, who's the friend of John Newton, who wrote the hymn Amazing Grace. And so here's just two sections from that hymn. God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Ye fearful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds ye so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessings on your head. Let's pray. God, thanks for the powerful truth that you are with us, even in the most challenging times. Every day we have the opportunity to hear your voice, to walk with you, to sit under your authority. Help us today to hear your voice clearly, to be encouraged and comforted in your presence. It's in your name we pray. Amen.